I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Inez Valdez, Associate Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. We're discussing her recent book, Democracy and Empire, Labor, Nature, and the Reproduction of Capitalism, from Cambridge University Press. Valdez's research is on critical race and feminist theory, migration, transnationalism, empire, and racial capitalism. She's the author most recently of Transnational Cosmopolitanism, as well as many articles in noted journals. Okay, well, first of all, Inez Valdez, welcome back to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
Inez, it's great to see you again. It's great to read another one of your books, which I enjoyed this one also very much. It's a great analysis of the relationship between popular sovereignty, empire, and capitalism, and it's a great read. I recommend it. Can you start just by talking to us a little bit about the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Sure. It was to some extent a natural follow-up to my 2019 book, which, as you know, it tracked the politics of solidarity among transnationally located subjects of empire. And so in a way, what I'm doing is kind of complemented the picture, because in Democracy and Empire, I turn to the politics of empire themselves, how these networks of oppression, but also states and the popular movements within wealthy industrialized countries that were kind of at the other side of imperial domination, how would these operate, and how do they operate not only in kind of conjunction with democracy, but also very much in conjunction with kind of race and racism. And so how race and racism as a form of hierarchy is key to imperial domination. In particular, I would say, since I read so much Du Bois for the first book, and there was this essay from 1914, The African Roots of War, that, you know, it makes us, I think, a quick appearance in the first book, but this is really the basis for kind of the theoretical claim of democracy and empire. Because in African Roots of War, Du Bois introduces this notion of democratic despotism. And the idea of democratic despotism is that despotism is not something kind of strange or separate from democracy, but that in the way in which enfranchisement, mass enfranchisement occurred in Western countries, very much it occurred as the polities that these workers or masses were demanding incorporation, they were empires. And so this incorporation or this popular demand was not a self-contained demand to self-government. It was a demand to both self-government, but also to partaking of this imperial wealth. So so what I do in the new book is really expand on this notion. I mean, I give it a new name to kind of capture this excessiveness. So I call it self and other determination. So self-determination is not what we observe in wealthy industrialized countries that were at the helm of empires. What we observe is self and other determination. So it's a claim to both determine themselves democratically and to despotically extract resources to make this commonwealth, to add to this commonwealth, to add to their well-being. And so, I think that's, in a nutshell, the motivation.
Yeah, that's great. I love this notion of democratic despotism. It reminds me, obviously, I mean, there's resonances with, say, Tocqueville with the idea of tyranny of the majority, sort of the idea, you know, that there's a tyrannical element embedded in democracy. Is that a similar kind of idea? Maybe you could, you know, just get us started by, you know, what the contrast, say, similarities and contrasts with the maybe more familiar term of tyranny of the majority.
Yes. So, I mean, with the tyranny of the majority, so one thing is that it's not the minority that is tyrannized. It's really a majority of the world, right? That comes under the imperial, that is part of the imperial domain, right? So that's the first thing. And this is something that Du Bois is very, very kind of invested in highlighting, right? It is the majority of the world that is ruled by a minority of the world. But I think the other something else that I would like to distinguish is that is that it is democracy, right? So I mean, we can think about democracy conceptually, but if we think about democracy as a practiced form of rule, we need to think about these moments of democratization, right? I mean, the 19th century and the turn of the century, right? Moments of mass enfranchisement. And so if we think of democracy as a practiced form of rule, this democracy has been imperial, right? And so that's why I do not want to kind of just simply assimilate it to tyranny and then separate it, but rather to really say this is a democratic form because it has this popular component. It has this self-government component, but it's also excessive in that sense. So I think that's one key distinction. So I should also mention that the title Democracy and Empire is kind of a pairing that was kind of a key area of debate among British liberals who were critics of empire. But I think, but what I'm doing is very different in the sense what. The fear of British liberals writing, so this is Hobson, among others. I mean, this is something that I think cover mostly in the introduction and chapter two. These thinkers were concerned, and political actors, I should say, were concerned with how imperialism was making Britain was kind of, in a way, acting to the detriment of the liberalism of England. And importantly, they actually highlighted the settler colonies as examples of democracy, right? So they were contrasting kind of this expansive empire that was kind of falling victim of its own kind of despotism abroad, but then the US and other self-governing settler colonies such as Canada and Australia were offered as contrast, right? And part of what I'm doing in chapter two is really looking at these moments of constitution, so to speak, or founding, democratic founding in these settler colonies, and showing how these moments of founding are also imperialist.
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, to get maybe you could give us a sense of the overall argument. I mean, the pairing democracy and empire is suggestive. I mean, there's other literature on sort of liberalism and empire. This is your book really focuses on the idea of popular sovereignty, its imperial character, and the sort of racial dimensions of it. So maybe you can give us a sense, just sort of how are these concepts sort of conceptually re related, not just sort of historically related, but sort of conceptually.
So I mean, vis-a-vis the political theory of empire, so this was really important literature in terms of kind of helping me think about empire. But also, I think there was a certain frustration with this literature that got me to the place kind of that. That this book comes from. And that is because the political theory of empire, so the work by Jennifer Pitts and Carolina Mantena and others, what they do is, I mean, they are very much kind of an intellectual history tradition, sort of Cambridge School, and they look at liberal texts and they track the imperial entanglements of liberalism, so to speak. But oftentimes, what they do is they actually see how kind of claims about universal claims about equality and liberty are sort of entangled with empire, and but empire is continuously disavowed, right? And so the interesting thing here is that then the political theory of empire is only looking at empire to the extent that it's a subtext in liberal writings about liberalism, right? And so I mean, the irony is that you're kind of theorizing empire by looking at these disavowals, right? So it's not that you get like kind of the archive of empire, right? And so in a way, the archive of empire, the actual forms of domination, the actual kind of connections with questions of race and hierarchy. I mean, that's also something very important there. I mean, there was no theorization of race and racism in the political theory of empire, and there was no theorization of capitalism, right? And so, I mean, I tend to understand imperialism as, I mean, with Oliver Cox, which is imperialism is a form of outward domination that is the means of existence for capitalism, right? I mean, imperialism was established in order to facilitate extraction of, I mean, exploitation of labor, land, and extraction of resources, right? And so I think those were the frustrations with the political theory of empire, right? It was very textual and not getting directly to the archives of empire, and then really not being very interested at all in questions of racism and questions of capitalism, despite the very close connection there. I mean, of course, I mean that there were I should say, I mean there were efforts to think about kind of what forms of, I mean, how discourses of difference or civilizational or cultural superiority transformed during this period, but not in the way in which theories of racism such as W.E.B. Du Bois, you can think about Oliver Cox, or the Black radical tradition more generally was not part of this this literature. So that's one way in which kind of they connect. I think the work of Ules Inche, 2018 book on colonial capitalism, I think is in the title. And so I think what he does there is bring in capitalism into discussions of colonialism and the political theory of empire, which this book is kind of very clearly in a dialogue with. So that was a very important book for me to think about how to incorporate capitalism into this discussion. But at the same time, the book ends with an examination of Wakefield as a theorist of colonialism. And in a way, what Wakefield is thinking about is how to govern the arriving British migrants into the US in order for them to become workers as opposed to landowners. So that is the problem that Wakefield aims to solve. And so, in a way, what I do in the book is kind of, well, yes, this was a problem, and but ultimately the problem that followed was when these groups of dispossessed British and other European arrivals into North America, when this group constituted themselves as a people, this is where questions of racism, questions of empire reemerge now as a problem that is going to be solved by incorporating these groups into an imperial democracy, right? So I think those are some connections. And I can say something more about the more recent anti-colonial theory. Is that sort of
Let me just to say one thing. I mean, but just because I my sort of vast simplification of your thesis is something like this. So let me just say this, and then you tell me where how you should make it more complex. But I find this idea very interesting, that the idea that to connect democracy and empire as opposed to liberalism and empire, which a lot of the literature, liberalism and empire, I suppose there is a connection with this idea of enlightenment and sort of rational self-governance that's sort of implicit in the liberal tradition. But you're right to say, I mean, in the democratic tradition, and thinking certainly in the sort of populist variants, sort of like right-wing populism, you see elements of sort of racial animus, racial groupishness. That's sort of embedded within the self-determination of a kind of democratic people, right? And that involves a kind of group psychology of like an us versus them type of situation, that I can very much see that can both have a kind of racial component, it can have an imperial component to sort of support the us over the them. And it yeah can I mean it can draw on capitalism as sort of the engine for the advancement of that group's interest. I mean, what about that? How's that sound?
I think that sounds right in the sense that it was precisely a kind of, I mean, the moment, of course, was very influential in I mean, the particular path that the book followed, in the sense that there is this, so there's this effort to sort of completely detach kind of this right wing kind of outbursts from kind of democracy, kind of the right kind of democracy. But what I'm trying to say in the book is that these are not kind of completely separated political phenomena, but that there is a moment of founding that was very much a moment in which this, I mean, these are to some extent some of Du Bois's terms, national feeling was also a possessive feeling. So it was not just kind of neatly political claim of constitution, as you know, the literature on peoplehood and popular sovereignty has kind of conceptualized, but it was a political claim, and it was also a claim to possession, to appropriating wealth. And so what I'm trying to do is say, look at this archive, right? And I was actually at the British Library looking at the British bureaucracy, correspondence exchanges with South Africa and Australia and Canada. And also discussions with the US, which of course was no longer a colony by the turn of the century. And so, but in these exchanges within the British bureaucracy, you really see the extent to which both possession and race are key elements that are recognized as part of these moments of constitution, right? And so my goal was to say, I mean, these outbursts have a historical grounding in the way in which these democracies were constituted in the West. And this is not just about the settler colonies, to the extent that you could see the way in which socialist parties I focus primarily in England, but there's also, I mean, interesting things going on in Germany. I know less about France, about the way in which the colonies were seen also by the working class as potentially, part of this kind of national wealth, and part of the opposition, for instance, to bringing Chinese migrants to Australia after the, sorry, to South Africa after the Second Boer War, was like, well, I mean, if the Chinese go, what about British subjects that want to actually go and become landowners or workers? So there was this very much view of the colonies as a way to of what's the word that's escaping me, of upward mobility. That's the word that's escaping me. So they were forms of upward mobility for the masses in Britain, right? And so I guess, I mean, if that, so that's why I think that's correct. I mean, that there is something that sounds very familiar when you read the book. And contemporary discourses. But what I'm trying to say is, like, yes, it's familiar because it is part of the fabric of democracy in the way in which it was inaugurated.
Yeah, good. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything more about other literature. I think I cut you off by intervening with a question. Did you want to sort of complete any other sort of ways in which you were connected with other literature? Yeah.
Just one more point. I mean, and
Yeah.
very quickly, because I mean, and my first book in a way does that, in the sense that it tends to think about kind of global injustice and kind of imperial formations as something that is kind of located in the international sphere, right? So we think about kind of global capitalism and you could even say unequal terms of exchange if you go back to this dependency language or trade regimes or investment regimes. So all of these international organizations are in a way faulted for global injustice, right? And this is also the way in which, for instance, well, my work that thinks transnationally, but also in the work by Adam Getachew that thinks about a project of world making as a project of reform of this unfair international set of institutions. And so there, what I try to do is sort of to go upstream, right? So to say, okay, so, but it's very difficult to extract anything from the international, right? I mean, nobody's there kind of sitting, with a bunch of resources that need to be redistributed because the resources are really going to countries. And so I wanted to see kind of, or to theorize how democracies wealthy, industrialized Western democracies, how they were also entangled with this kind of very unequal kind of global arena. And my claim is that it is at this level, at the level of democratic democracies, that you see already kind of this impetus to domination, to unjustly appropriate resources, and to oppress other peoples in the process, right? So there was this kind of upstream move vis-a-vis this focus. I mean, I think the work of Anthony Angie in particular, this legal scholar, and this, you know, very early on, he said, well, I mean, the problem is international institutions, because this is the way in which they are, they integrate weaker countries in burdened ways. They establish trade rules in ways that are burdensome, and so on and so forth, right? So it's a very very common site of theorization, the global. And so I wanted to go kind of what happened before, kind of who are the actors that determine this global architecture.
Yeah, good. I mean, do you want to maybe you want to say a little bit about some more examples? You referred to a couple examples in chapter two about the sort of British imperial rule, and you've done some archival work, drawn some other theory contemporary theorists. Maybe you know, if you sort of want to flesh out the theorists, and we're talking about, you know, the first part of your book where you talk about imperial. The imperial domination of democracies in the modern age. So maybe if that would be helpful for you to, you know, sort of lay out some kind of examples here for us.
Yes, I mean, so in a way, the first part, I mean, chapters one and two. So chapter one looks at the notion of democratic despotism and develops it into the notion of self and other determination, and then goes on to think about how this unequal relationship gets transformed and updated to the present. The second one, as I mentioned, was this look into these notions of self-government in the settler colonies. And then that's the first part. And then with the second part, sort of I move into the examples, right? And I mean, and they are examples, but they are also kind of, you know, in a way, sub-arguments, in the sense that what I claim in the first part, that there is a popular demand to appropriate imperial wealth, the kind of the claim there is a claim that this is a form of rule, right? It's a collective ruling other groups outside, although sometimes as well inside a polity, right? And so chapters three and four are focus on the question of kinship and labor, kind of labor done for social reproduction, and the question of manual labor and land. And so they are examples, but they are also trying to say, look at how these are relationships of rule. And so let me focus on the first one, that is chapter three. And so what I try to do there is to look at the provision of labor, migrant labor from Mexico into the United States as a historically kind of long durée kind of form of rule, right? And here there's something that I didn't say about chapter two, but something that is really important, and I think perhaps it's going to come out in some of the conversation if we move into the conversation about migration, is that I think migration used to be imperial forms of labor control, right? And so at some point, states absorb these functions. But this is why I tend not to kind of trust claims about states have the right to self-determination and have the right to control migration, because I tend to see it historically as something that was part of empire. You would move Indian laborers into the Caribbean when you abolish slavery in the plantations. You would move Chinese labor into the US and Canada when you needed to build railways. and so on and so forth, right? So that's the first thing that acts as a background to what I'm going to say now about Mexico and the US. And so what I do in Mexico when in the chapter on social reproduction and kinship is to say, well, the question of conquest followed by irregular migration and really, I mean, non-regulated migration, I guess you could say, followed by the Bracero program, followed by our present of surveilled migration and mass deportation. These are all forms or can be understood as forms of labor control that are achieved in very different ways. So conquest, annexed territory, resulted in Anglo settlement and the mass loss of land and the mass de-skilling of Mexican labor. The Bracero program represented a kind of tightly controlled form of labor, particularly in the second part of the program when the US was no longer at war, and so the questions of labor scarcity were less pressing. And so labor control with lack of mobility and great exploitation. And then think about the moment of extreme surveillance, interior policing of migration of today, right? So all of these forms of labor exchange, you could say, between the US as well as territory exchange between the US and Mexico can be understood as setting the conditions for the creation of vulnerable labor. And what I do in addition to that, and so these are forms of rule in the sense that you can identify particular political formations, conquest and settlement, controlled and kind of sanctioned guest labor, and now kind of the Department of Homeland Security and its many policing arms, right? So these are forms of rule, state rule, and authority. But also, what I want to do is connect these historical events with particular forms of kinship. And so in particular, the destruction of kinship among those racialized and recruited for labor. And so I track forms of family separation that are continuous. So both the disruption of kinship due to conquest, but also, of course, the separation in the mainly male migration that was characteristic of the Bracero program. And then in the present period, separation both as a predominantly female migration that kind of fits into service and care work, but also the regime of deportation and border control, which separates families, both because they leave family members behind and because family members are uprooted through detention and deportation, right? And so the example there is, and at the same time, how these brown laborers come to fulfill key aspects, key functions of the economy that keep privileged families comfortable and cared for, right? You know, you can think of food, I mean, the growing of food, you can think about services, you can think about all of this gig economy based, you know, easy access to everything that are provided by migrant labor, right? And so you want to focus both the white family and this privatized white family that is able to cater to its needs and kind of the families that are destroyed in the process of providing these jobs. So that went a little bit too long, but I think it I wanted to kind of, you know, fairly cover that is both kind of a historical argument and an argument about thinking of migration as part of historical regimes of labor control. And I think it illuminates some of what we're living today, but also the way in which previous regimes built towards the present.
Yeah, that's great. And it's a great example of how sort of the sort of imperial democratic character of the past, say the 19th century United States, sort of continues to, you know, insinuate itself in the present, even in so-called, you know, like the sort of neoliberal retreat of, some of that aspiration, right? It's still sort of embedded in it. And, you know, it's helpful to see this as a sort of continuous story, both at the left and the right, and not sort of, I mean, so in your view, this is not simply the sort of fault of any one particular political party. I mean, immigration in the United States, as you all know, is not something that either party really has been able to get a handle on. So this is, you know, this is a story that's a, you know, fault of both left and the right, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And to add just one small thing, I mean, I should say that the connection is both historical, but also, I mean, the way in which I draw from feminist theorists, Black feminist theorists, and Indigenous feminist theorists, as well as Latinx scholars, the question of the commodification of kinship, and this is, you know, I'm thinking about Hortense Spillers and Angela Davis and Saidiya Hartman, in particular, is the way in which, I mean, paradigmatically, of course, the Black family during slavery was commodified. Its kinship ties were denied, were destroyed. And the same happens when you think about residential schools and other forms of displacement and confinement for Indigenous peoples. And so I think it's important to say that this destruction of kinship is also kind of generalizable across this set of racialized groups, in addition to historically.
Yeah, that's good. I'm more familiar, you probably know, with this sort of analytic political philosophy tradition and thinking about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like Sarah Song, I had her on the podcast now, gosh, some time ago now, time flies, but she wrote this book on immigration. And I just wonder what you make of a kind of approach like that, which is, I think, generally sympathetic to your view, in the sense that, you know, Sarah has a view that family separation is normatively wrong, right? So we should be, in thinking about state policies of immigration, we should be think that sort of maintaining family bonds is something normatively important and salient. And obviously all this sort of imperial stuff that the United States did in the past is wrong. Nevertheless, one of the crucial things that she wants to hold on to is the idea of the sort of, you know, normative value of a community's self-determination,
mm-hmm.
generally, which is that, you know, any national community should have the power to determine itself, and part of that is to sort of determine its, you know, the character of its of its immigration policies, who to let in, who not. Now, obviously, there's sort of boundary, you know, no community is sort of unlimited authority when it comes to that. But I guess I don't know if this is helpful or not, but what I want to push you on is to think about, you know, ask you to say a little bit about maybe the idea of self-determination itself, and whether you think, you know, whether your project here is extending towards a sort of skepticism of the value of self-determination in the way that this analytic political philosophy tradition does, or whether you see a place for it, and what you think, I guess, generally about that kind of analysis when thinking about immigration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good question, because, I mean, this is the literature that I started reading when I was in graduate school and I was thinking about migration. And in fact, the first version of chapter 2 that came out in Political Theory does close by addressing not Sarah Song, but Michael Blake and second theorist whose name is escaping me. But then in the book, I turn to engage more directly with actually critical theory. So, you know, I mean, like even among critical theories, some of these kind of accounts of migration are lost, or their connection to, you know, to their foundational character towards democracy is missed, right? So, but just that's just kind of a preface to say that yes, I've thought about kind of analytical philosophy and other approaches to migration, and here I guess you might expect, you know, my objection is how ahistorical these accounts are. And that's why, you know, the book starts by saying that there is not self-determination as such. Self-determination in wealthy countries has always been excessive, has always aimed at ruling over, and definitely, you know, ruling over in order to extract resources from beyond its borders, right? And so then, yeah, perhaps self-determination would be an acceptable principle to think about migration admissions if self-determination as a self-contained principle ever existed. But I had my doubts that it ever existed. And so then to kind of to cite a principle that we have seen, we haven't seen kind of prevailing as a rationale to make a claim about migration, which is a very current problem, it seems to be kind of to rely on this myth in order to make a claim about an existing problem, right? And so and so I think that if we are going to make a claim about an existing problem, we need to think about whether this self-containedness of polities has ever occurred. So that's the first thing, right? I mean, I do think that, I mean, I am convinced that wealthy countries do not self-determine, they engage in self and other determination. So that's the first thing. But then the second thing pertains more directly to the question of migration, right? It's so part of what I find extremely kind of rewarding of having incorporated a discussion of capitalism into a discussion of democracy and empire is that it's a much richer way of understanding political life, right? And so theorists of migration working in the analytical tradition, they may say, oh, you know, these countries are very poor and, you know, and migrants are coming to wealthy countries. And of course, you know, if these inequalities are so extreme, then there will be reasons kind of to let them in. And definitely, of course, they would all accept grounds for letting in kind of asylum seekers and so on. But I think that thinking about migration as something or like, oh, look at these people, they just decided to come and now they're here at our borders and we need to decide what to do with them, right? And I think that that again is an ahistorical way of understanding global mobility, right? So migration into the settler colonies was kind of an escape valve for poverty and potential labor unrest in Europe, right? I mean, I have the numbers in chapter two, like the millions and millions of people that left Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries. So that's one kind of that one way of thinking about this first kind of you know, flow of migrants. And then this was followed, and I already mentioned this, by kind of imperial arrangements in terms of how to secure the appropriate amount of labor to add to the land that had been appropriated in the Caribbean, in plantations, in the mines, in South America in during the Spanish and Portuguese colonialism. And so came slavery. And then slavery was abolished, and then so came indentured labor by Indian, performed by Indian and Chinese workers, right? And so we cannot think about migration as if these kind of global flows of people were kind of not part of kind of how our world came about. And the same goes with when we think about labor in the US today, right? I mean, we know that over 50% of farm workers in the US are migrants. And at least 50% are undocumented migrants, right? And so this is a story of vulnerable labor conscripted to produce, kind of to provide us with food, right? And so if I abstract from all of this and say, well, let's think about what to do with this person waiting at the border, I just find it, I guess, you know, I just said that I think adding capitalism and political economy enriches. So I just find it impoverishing to think based on principles that are not informed by this history and present of political economy. And once we think about that, then the principles of justice are quite different. I mean, they involve the question of exploitation. They involve the question of undocumented status and further vulnerability. And so on. So I guess that's my two kind of pronged kind of.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. I mean, yeah, right. I was just thinking when you were just saying that, that some, you know, sort of Marxian comment or Marxian concepts would become useful to sort of to draw in about exploitation or alienation, that sort of inequality of power, bargaining power, so forth. It leads me to the question. I wonder, you know, in the sense of you know, sort of how Marxian your project is at bottom. I mean, is it, because one, I think one way to read what you're doing, and I don't think this is what you're doing, but is to think of it as a sort of Marxian analysis. That is that, you know, sort of capitalism is driving all this. And then like popular sovereignty and race are epiphenomenal ideological mechanisms that people in the West use in order to justify the inequalities that exist under capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it might help me if you, and maybe, I don't know, people listening, if there are any people listening, so is that, I mean, how far would you go with that? Is like the sort of epiphenomenal character of popular mm-hmm. sovereignty? I take it you want to argue that popular sovereignty and the racial issues are actually more fundamental than that, right?
Right. Yes. I mean, absolutely. I mean, the story is kind of so far from the deterministic kind of, you know, class. I mean, it's precisely, I mean, that's what racial capitalism does, is to say precisely, I mean, this story where, you know, the distinction between capitalists and workers, that is way too deterministic and way too inaccurate a story, right? We need to think both about kind of divisions. I mean, I mean divisions of race and how race kind of, you know, divides the working class and so alters this distinction that would be just, you know, capitalists and the proletariat. So that's the first thing. But then, I mean, also the kind of the very what's the word I'm looking for? So I guess would be the word I'm looking for is the opposite of kind of an easy kind of simple kind of progress forward of capitalism, right? I mean, imagine the amounts of adjustments and political arrangements and transformation of those political arrangements that had to kind of take place, including emancipatory movements that curtailed kind of forms of accumulation that would have otherwise prevailed. So I already mentioned the abolition of slavery, but I mean, you can even think about when it comes to racial divisions within the working class. I mean, there are ways of thinking. There are ways. Paths in which you could have thought about other arrangements that would have resulted in more profitable kind of forms of exploitation. So, I mean, there is a story that I tell in chapter one in which there is sort of a transformation of working class activism from anti-capitalist ideas towards kind of wage-based demands, right? And I mean, and this requires that a certain group of workers is in a way upgraded, right? And this particular sort of quid pro quo is, well, I mean, will, you know, provide a better kind of better remuneration and better conditions of work to this particular subgroup in order to, or while at the same time kind of creating jobs and very exploitative conditions for other groups, right? So I mean this had to be a political response to both kind of labor activism, but also kind of the result of divisions that are not the same in every country and that depend on particular kind of encounters between, in the case of the United States, indigenous peoples, slaves, and then freedmen and women, indigenous peoples from Mexico in the annexed territories, and then, you know, Chinese migrants that are then kind of, you know, completely limited. And so, and I think that's a key part that I think want to emphasize, right? The way in which restrictionism is limiting capitalists' ability to continue exploiting and recruiting Chinese labor, right? And so then again, so there is this, you know, effort to bring in this source of Chinese labor, and then there is a political limit to that. And so there's an effort to kind of rearrange. And so then Mexican labor is partially substituting for Chinese labor, and that is why Mexican labor is not covered by the quota law since 1924, right? And so there is too much politics there to make this a simple story of it is capitalism equalizing kind of all and exploiting all proletarians of the world that will then unite. So it is not a Marxist story, also in the sense that the proletarians of the world very much do not unite, right? But rather become, split into differently racialized groups and subject to very particular social and political formations.
That's
metropole or in the colonial areas.
That's helpful. I mean, racism and national boundaries are really bad for business. I mean, bad for capitalism. Right? So, you know, like Marx predicted the decline and disillusion of national differences, and, you know, that the sort of capitalism would finally break down the Chinese walls, as he said, right? And so famously didn't happen after sort of intensification of national differences and national strife and racial disagreement. So, I mean, that's very helpful to think of it as sort of the, you know, balance among these different sort of independent variables. I don't know what to say, but you know, sort of among popular sovereignty, popular self-rule, self-determination, racial self-determination, and capitalism as all in the mix here. Let's turn to the last part of your book and thinking about the hopeful character of the book. I mean, we've been talking about your critical part, but you conclude the book by talking about the emancipatory potential that is in the notion of popular sovereignty, especially as it's developed in thinkers like Martin Luther King and Frantz Fanon. So maybe you could say a little bit about what you take that emancipatory potential to be, or what these thinkers take it to be, and what form it might have to take.
Mm-hmm. This chapter on Martin Luther King and Frantz Fanon, I really enjoyed writing it. And of course, it's articulated around Vietnam in the sense that it reads this essay by King, Beyond Vietnam, Time to Break Silence, and the way in which Fanon also engages with Vietnam as this very important kind of exemplar kind of moment for the colonial world. And so because of that essay, the essay Beyond Vietnam, really what you see is how King was really thinking transnationally when it came to articulate what precisely was wrong with Vietnam, right? And so I think oftentimes he's been read as saying, well, what is wrong with Vietnam is that all of these resources are going into a war. Well, we have so many needs. There's the kind of, anti-poverty campaign. And I think what he's actually saying is, well, the problem here is that American elites are recruiting, poor Americans to go fight for Vietnamese elites, to support Vietnamese elites who are actually they're being ousted by the Vietnamese people, not just by the Viet Cong, right? And so this account of kind of what I call symbiotic elites, I think is key. And it fits very nicely with Fanon's critique in The Wretched of the Earth of post-colonial elites that have been co-opted by colonial countries. And so the positive case for an anti-imperial popular sovereignty needs to take into account that this is the world that we live in, right? It's not a world in which post-colonial countries are oppressed, but it's a world in which post-colonial countries have emerged out of colonialism with a very unequal structure that is reflected in a particular oligarchic formation that needs to be considered if we are to to oppose oppression and the further exploitation of labor and land. So this is the sense in which I say, you know, popular sovereignty ought to be transnational. It ought to consider that the actors who that there are affinities between actors around the world, and that because of that, they need to fight for emancipation together. Now, I mean, this sounds extremely improbable in a world that is organized in nation states, and I mean, part of that is some of what I did in my first book, right? I mean, we can't find instances of cooperation and solidarity between groups that kind of deny that a world of nation states and international interstate organizations is the only game in town on the one hand. But on the other hand, we really need to grapple with this problem of, you know, it's an oligarchic world, and it is neither in the interest of the American people or the British people or whatever kind of, you know, industrialized country you want to put as an example. It is not the people that is benefiting from these imperial policies. Or at least, I mean, they are benefiting to the extent that they are kind of co-opted and sort of rewarded. But what we see in the neoliberal period is that this world, you know, the world that I depict, that then kind of peaks in the post-war and the golden age of the welfare state, is not the world that we have today, right? I mean, this is a post-1980s neoliberal revolution world. But what worries me is that when we kind of have to resort to emancipatory narratives, these emancipatory narratives are just asking again for a return to this imperial world in which I get to appropriate the spoils of empire. And so then while I recognize that this world of, you know, in which the white working class kind of benefits from the imperial spoils is no longer, partly because we are in a post welfare state world, we do need to think, if we want to think in emancipatory directions, we cannot go back to this kind of self-contained popular sovereignty. I take care of kind of my own and in a very racialized way of defining my own. I think to that account of anti-oligarchic popular sovereignty, I add an account of ecological popular sovereignty, and this draws on chapter 4 that I actually didn't talk much about today. But the goal there is to think about how the exploitation of labor, and this goes back to the notion of labor in Marx, right? This is the metabolic relation between man and nature. And so this metabolic relation between man and nature, in which I mix my labor with the materials given to me by nature, this metabolic relation can be oriented to produce things for my needs and the needs of a particular community, or it can be redirected to produce, I don't know, plastic gadgets for no reason whatsoever that has to do with human needs, right? And so this the redirection of labor towards accumulation, capitalist accumulation, is also a redirection towards the exhaustion of resources, right? Because I'm going to overuse land, overuse metals, overuse fossil fuels, use fossil fuels to begin with, and so on and so forth. And so this popular sovereignty that is also emancipatory really needs to think about how the establishment of a community is also must thematize a relationship with nature, with land, and the uses that it can be put or not, right? And so it's both transnational and kind of grounded. And here in the conclusion, I draw from indigenous political thought precisely to think about this problem. And I show the continuities between some of the critiques that we find in Du Bois and Marx, which have been in particular developed by eco-socialists, people like Kohei Saito or John Bellamy Foster, among others. that there is sort of an ecological Marx, and there is definitely an ecological Du Bois with a strong critique of technology and strong critique of racialized technology that I think we ought to listen to orient how constitutions of political communities are also constitutions of relationships with nature. And if we leave that unthought, someone else is gonna think about it and run with it. So, and I think, you know, so much discussion about the Green New Deal and the successive kind of failed efforts to constrain emissions and so on are precisely kind of evidence that this is not something that we ever considered as a political question until it became too late.
Yeah, I love this idea of sort of, you know, transcending national popular sovereignty to sort of connect with sort of cosmopolitan goals of unity with other peoples, unity with nature. I wonder at that point, though, whether the notion of popular sovereignty itself, whether it's no longer useful in a certain way. I mean, I guess so, because the way you pitch it in this part is that it's actually a feature of popular sovereignty, that mm-hmm. or another side to it as emancipatory. Why not think of it as just rejecting popular sovereignty and doing something else? Like, so what is it about popular sovereignty, I think, that you still want to hold on to here?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I sort of agonized about that as I was writing the conclusion in particular, I mean, in chapter five as well. I mean, I do think that there is kind of an aspect of popular sovereignty, I mean, the aspect that this is a collective endeavor and the aspect that it is... Yeah, I mean, the aspect of sovereignty, the aspect that, you know, it is a form of authority, it is a form of rule. What I want to kind of, you know, get rid of is that this entails kind of setting boundaries. Although, I mean, I do want to set boundaries, right? But the boundaries need to, and this is where I draw from Robin Kimmerer, right? The boundaries are around kind of the particular practices toward others and towards land that might be kind of conceived as part of a kind of democratic collective, right? And so I do want rule and authority, but rather than kind of setting up boundaries around people that are in and people that are out, people that are kind of beneficiaries and people that are exploited, these boundaries need to differentiate between practices that are regenerative towards nature and reciprocal toward others. So this, and this requires some sort of authority, right? Some sort of rule. So I don't think that I have it completely figured out, partly because I spent less time in the book kind of thinking about that. But yeah, so it is the collective and reciprocal aspect and the aspect of rule that I want to keep. I just want to rule in different ways. If you just want it to rule in different ways, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So let's conclude with your conclusion. I mean, you talk a little bit about implications for contemporary politics and policy. You know, I mean, you just get put the question in a general way. I mean, what do you think about how your book could, you know, and the findings, the conclusions of your book can help sort of inform contemporary politics, maybe improve them on the kinds of scores that you're talking about? Anything in particular we can improve? Immigration policy, for example, or yeah. Capitalist political economy. I was thinking maybe if there's an example that you have of some policy or area in the contemporary world that gives you hope for the future on some of these counts.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. I mean, it's a very hard question too. So I mean, I will say that, you know, I'm Walter Benjamin, you know, a fan as well, you know, a reader of Walter Benjamin. And so I tend to think about it also in terms of, you know, historical constellations, right? So, right, I'm looking not just for examples kind of today, but examples kind of in history. And I think, and this has to do with my, you know, my new project is on dependency theory as a as an anti-colonial theory. And so, you know, I've been looking at these examples of democratic socialism in Chile, in with Allende in 1969, and with Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. And of course, both of these efforts ended in coups, right? But these were, I mean, in a way, really revolutionary in the sense that they had as a goal the reappropriation of resources and their kind of deployment for serving, you know, human needs. I mean, the needs of particular political communities, and precisely for the reason they were, you know, staunchly opposed and ultimately toppled in with a coordination between military, domestic military force and U.S. support. But nonetheless, I think like this idea, I mean, when we think about questions of nationalization and land reform and so on and so forth, when we think about them in terms of what I was just talking about, popular sovereignty, right? The way in which we can rethink land and nature as something that can be used to fulfill needs rather than to be used to serve whatever kind of multinational corporation was extracting the copper here, or growing the copper in Chile, or growing bananas in Guatemala, right? So, so I think there's a way in which I've come to see these projects of land reform and nationalization very differently once I wrote this book and came to see kind of, you know, the way of labor with nature and to what it is devoted. So that will be two things. The other thing, you know, the debate on migration, the public debate on migration, it's just very narrow and superficial currently, and I think it's only going to get more so as we approach the elections. We know that, you know, the response of the Biden administration was to say, look, we can be as harsh as you are. Here's our law. And then, well, the law wasn't passed because Trump, you know, instructed Congress not to pass the law, right? But there is a way in which the debate on migration is focused on this threat coming south of the border and these people taking our jobs and so on and so forth. And so what is getting obscured there is the way in which immigrant activists, so I'm thinking of the National Day Labor Alliance, let me see, National Day Labor Organizing Network, that's what it's called, NDLON, National Day Labor Organizing Network, which organizes day laborers around the country, so organize kind of brings together several organizations working with day laborers. I'm thinking about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers organizing farm workers in Florida, and the many groups kind of opposing and organizing against immigration detention and deportation. So, I mean, these groups are really getting at the core problem of migration, which is on the one hand, questions of labor exploitation, and on the other hand, the existence of a internal policing regime of surveillance, detention and deportation, right? And so, I think these are the really kind of problematic notes and really the core of what migration is about for me. And so to the extent that they illuminate and kind of contest this these modes of political rule, they give me some hope. But I think it's, yeah, very much kind of, you know, in the past and in this very, very kind of small and I mean, it's not decentralized in the sense that, you know, there are networks of also day laborers and, you know, farm worker organizing in Central America, Canada, and the US. There are really kind of these connections are being made by organizing groups. It's just that they don't manage to break in the debate. And the last thing I will say is that while they don't manage to break in the debate necessarily, I mean, there are really interesting initiatives aiming to change the narrative on migration. And I don't have them right now, but I can, you know, send them. So there is a recognition among a portion of the population that this debate on migration is not doing any good to both the understanding of what immigration is about, but also to the kinds of notions of community and politics that then get translated into very problematic right-wing groups, both here and in Europe. I mean, Europe is it's another important year in Europe with several elections that are revolving around the question of migration and with similar ways of thinking about it. So I think that this grassroots organizing among migrants that are pointing out, I think these problematic notes are part of what I would say.
Right. Well, Nez, thanks so much for this great conversation. And thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the conversation. I really enjoyed it, and I'm thankful for your engagement.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.